Canto 26 of the Paradise begins with this really extraordinary situation in which Dante has gone blind in the high heavens of the fixed stars. John, the apostle closely associated with love, has appeared to him, and he has dazzled Dante, not just with his brightness, but with the way that Dante has tried to look at John. Dante had tried to see whether John had ascended into heaven in bodily form. And I think that Dante's desire to see that is not just about this story which went around in the medieval world that John had indeed ascended in bodily form into heaven. There's something more immediate in Dante that has drawn his desire to see whether that's true of John, and has therefore misdirected his desire, misdirected his sight. And it's that misdirection which is going to be fine-tuned here in Canto 26. I think it's worth remembering that the higher you ascend, it's not the easier it becomes. In a way, it's the more difficult it becomes, because every nudge, every step, every inflection becomes more and more consequential. It can knock you off course. And we're going to see something of that, I think, here in Canto 26 as well. So this blindness is a fine-tuning. And in fact, at the beginning of Canto 26, that's made clear, because Dante is told by John that he can rest assured about this blindness. He's told that Beatrice can restore it as quickly as it has gone. She has the capability of Ananias, who was the chap that restored the sight of Paul after Paul went blind with the vision of the risen Christ on the road to Damascus. And I think that's quite a clue for us here to understanding what's going on for Dante, because, of course, the point about Paul was that he thought he was on the right path. His zeal was at full strength, his focus, his sight, what he thought he saw about Judaism and this new figure of Jesus, he thought was fully focused, and he was on a mission. And yet it was taking him in the wrong direction, and he needed to have that halt, that vision, which could cut right across his apparent sight of things, and so reorientate them in this very dramatic way, hence a Damascene experience. I think it's not quite so extreme for Dante now. And in fact, Ananias is just mentioned rather than the whole of Paul's story being invoked. But there's something still about Dante's vision having to be adjusted, if not completely turned around. Again, we might not completely unexpect this. In many spiritual traditions, there's this stage of bewilderment, as it's often called in the Sufi tradition, where the seeming adept is well aligned, is well on the way, is long embarked on the spiritual journey. And yet they have this moment, which turns out to be almost before they reach the pinnacle of their spiritual ascent, where it seems almost as if everything is lost. It's often said in the Sufi tradition that the sheikh starts drinking, turning to the forbidden alcohol, or falls in love with a Christian and seems to have lost the plot. It's particularly, I think, associated with spiritual traditions that emphasize the centrality of the erotic, of erotic love. This is a very powerful way of aligning with the divine, which is why it's so tremendous, but also why it's so tricky. And I think that as well, Dante too is having to have a kind of adjustment here. His desire has slightly got ahead of him here in the high heavens. And John tells him, in fact, that with the blindness, he must now turn to his soul's desire. He must look inward and adjust his sight from that vantage. If you like, his gross sight, seeing the light of John, had led him a bit astray, and he now needs to adjust it by looking again at what his deepest alignment is with, making touch with that once more. It's a kind of moment of retreat, trying to re-establish the inward vision, which is the true compass for alignment with divine. Helen Lute makes the observation that the spiritual path is often about monitoring this edge between outer sight, outer action, outer course in life, and inner sight, inner action, inner discernment of what's going on, and turning back to the centre, back to where truth is fully to be found, is something we need to do sort of all day, every day, if you like, to adjust what's going on in our manifest life. Again, quite a common observation in spiritual traditions that truth actually sits within us, and that's where our point of orientation is to be found. Just one more inflection on this before looking at the canto more directly. It's also worth remembering that when Lucifer fell into the depths of the inferno, it was because he was close to God. He was the creature of light, and it was his very proximity to the divine that led to his such a precipitous fall. And we also reflected on how Judas might well have been the disciple closest to Jesus's mission. He understood it almost the best, and that is why he too had the furthest to fall. And there's something perhaps of that here for Dante as well, that he's, you know, getting close now to leaving the sphere of the fixed stars into the heavenly hierarchies and in the Imperium itself. And so at this moment as well, there's an adjustment that needs to be made to ensure that he's not going to, you might say, enter the highest heavens too quickly. He needs to make sure that this fine nuance, a bit like the great musical performance, is thoroughly embedded within him, because in a way the more beautiful a performance becomes, the more alert we become to the slightest mistake, which feels like it could throw the whole thing off. Dante himself, when he speaks at the beginning of Canto 26, is trusting of the situation. He says straight away that he knows that Beatrice is with him, that the love which entered through the gates of his eyes when he first saw her is still a love that is holding him now. It's a wonderful moment where he almost in his mind's eye looks right across back to the first moment when love was kindled within him. At that point, with all its confusion, with all its infatuation, with all its lack of discernment. But it's as if he can see now that it was this strong current that drew him right through his life to this point, and she is beside him still, and so he trusts that love. And he then also remarks that it's a love that can speak in louder or softer tones. He knows that as well. Sometimes it speaks with the calm voice that draws you towards the delicate beauty. Sometimes it screams and shouts at you, you might say. And he's known both aspects of love in his life as well. But he also says straight away to John that he knows that love is the alpha and omega of all texts. He's both, I think they're referring to the biblical text that begins and ends with divine love. He, of course, is a poet and so knows that love is the current that ultimately has drawn him through all his efforts at writing. And so he's saying to John here in the sphere of love with John's light of love present, that he understands that love is drawing him still, and that this moment of bewilderment, as he says, in fact, may be necessary. He's trusting it. He's still got his hope and his faith firmly in fixed place. John then affirms to Dante that he needs a finer sieve, as he puts it, in order to sift through this theme of love. And he encourages Dante to speak some more and asks Dante how he found this path of love, how he established himself on its way. And Dante explains in a speech that is noticeably, I think, focused. For example, there aren't extended similes. It feels quite rational in this sense of displaying a kind of inner intelligence, an inner orientation that has guided him. And so it demonstrates what this more nuanced kind of love is about, maybe in contrast to the wilder passions that he's experienced at other times. And what he tells John is that it was both philosophical argument, so that's the sifting with the loving intelligence of life and becoming orientated towards love in that way. But also it was, as he puts it, the authority which comes from here, from the high heavens. So revelation as well, love that was drawing him towards itself as much as him finding it within himself. And he says that what he's learnt is twofold. On the one hand, he's realised that love has the capacity to orientate us, because the more that we see of the good in life, the more that love falls for that goodness and so draws us more and more to what is good. That's how love works. It channels us towards what's good, precisely because the more we see of the good, the more we desire that good and so get drawn towards it. But then there's a second aspect that Dante explains to John as well, which is that as you draw more and more towards the good, so you realise that the things which immediately are displaying the good to you, and perhaps the natural world, perhaps people around you, and perhaps thoughts, insights, perceptions, the more you realise that they are just reflections or echoes of that which is good in itself. And so this refining along the path of love also makes what is truly lovely more and more clear as well. It's focusing at the same time on that which is worth loving wholly for itself, that which is good, beautiful and true, and which is the source of all other loveliness. It is this sense of love emanating out across the cosmos that this picture builds up. Dante explains to John that this is echoed in the story of Moses standing before God and seeing God's glory, the one true source of all goodness. And it's also seen in John's own gospel, in the beginning of the gospel, where John says, "In the beginning was the Word." Only someone with this right focus on love could write such a statement and see it so clearly. And John is very pleased with Dante's response, says, "You're speaking truly of love." But then he asks Dante a second question and says, "What were the teeth of love that held you in life?" It's a very striking, powerful metaphor. I think the idea is that Dante's given the overarching philosophical view of love and how it can work and draw us in life to that which is good in itself. And now what John wants is for Dante to celebrate, to show how more imminently love has held him on its path, how it has drawn him towards the good. This is the more immediate sense of love that we might have in life, even as at the same time we might have this more overarching sense of the arc of love and how it draws us towards the good. And Dante very quickly, very directly, gives a sort of sample of the things that immediately in life have awoken him to love. He says, existence itself, that sense of being alive, the consciousness, the bliss that that brings, the quiet astonishment of that, the wonder, just a moment's reflection on being alive can awaken you to the depths out of which that life has arisen. And then also his own life, when he reflects upon that as well, that too can give him a sense of a sustaining love in life. He then references Jesus who died, and I'm sure that is in part the story of Christ offering all out of love. But then I guess this also captures how people can give their lives in smaller everyday ways as well, out of love, helping others. So when you look at that, you see love actually is shaping and patterning all things every day through life. And then Dante says that he notes the faithful around him, how many, many people in big ways and small are living lives which, one way or another, not perfectly often, but still carry this sense of love's momentum. And he says that when he's attuned to the immediacy of love in this way, every leaf enleafs life with this love. It's a lovely image of a garden, life as a garden full of life. It echoes the Garden of Eden. It portrays God as the eternal gardener. And so every aspect of life is full of this love when you're tuned to it in this way. So Dante has complemented his overarching vision with a sense that directly, immediately, in every way, he has known, at least at times, and he knows it now fully, this sense of love's presence. And at this, a holy, holy, holy breaks out around him. This triune sense of celebration returns. If you remember, it had disappeared at the end of the last canto, as well as with his sight. It returns now. And moreover, Dante starts to see that his sight is being restored. He says that it was a bit like awakening from sleep. Before you open your eyes, you start to realise there's light coming through your lids. He says he felt Beatrice clearing away every speck of darkness that had fallen before him. Over the course of about three tercets, Dante gives us the sense of Dante's sight being restored. There's a sense, I think, of him rejoining the heaven around him, having turned in for this moment of reflection, re-established himself in his inner sense of these things, means that he's able to connect with the outer manifestation of this lovely life, which is all around him. But it doesn't stop there. He says that his sight feels stronger than it did before, as you might expect. The whole path of his journey through paradise is with the strengthening of his sight as it deepens, as it becomes more nuanced, as it is able to see all these different things like faith, like hope, like love manifest in these high places. But he says that as his strengthened sight enabled him to actually see the lights around him once more, the first thing that he sees is actually a new light, a fourth light. Another brightness has joined Peter, James, and John. And Beatrice tells him who this fourth light is. It turns out that it's Adam, the first man. And Dante says that he was like a tree, momentarily caught in a gust of wind, bent over, but with a natural resilience, making it stand up again. He's really quite surprised to see Adam here. And to cut to the chase, I think that this is both what he's now capable of seeing, but also what he needs to see. Because I think this whole thing about him looking at John to see whether John's body was present in the high heavens isn't just to do with the medieval story that John ascended. It's to do with Dante's own journey and his humanity. I think what has been happening in the sphere, particularly of the Sphinx stars, since he moved through the constellation of Gemini, is that he is having to realise that he himself is capable of containing the divine life. He himself can become an incarnation of God. And it's coming closer to that possibility, feeling into how it might be so, that he is able to keep rising through these highest heavens. It's, I think, the true deep insight of Christianity, that incarnation is both how God reached out to us and how we return to God. But of course, it's not a straightforward thing, because we are asked to bring all that we are into this activity. If divine grace reaches down to us, our work, as we learnt in the discussion about hope, is about aligning to that grace in order to make it possible. It's the long work, as well as the momentary work, of saying yes to God. And I think that the next stage of that for Dante now comes with him seeing Adam. Because, as he says, Adam isn't just a kind of fascinating spiritual figure worth seeing for its own sake, but Adam, in a way, is a type of humanity that is still within us. That's why Adam is such a significant figure. Because the thing about Adam is that he was created perfect. He was created mature. He was created capable of communion with the divine before the fall. And so meeting Adam now is bringing Dante into close contact, proximity with an aspect of himself, his prelapsarian state, which I think is going to be important for him to grapple with as well. And how so is shown in the questions which he asks Dante. He immediately wants to ask Dante questions. As is often the case in the Divine Comedy, it's not always immediately clear quite why he wants to ask these questions. They're questions which are interesting for their own sake at this literal level, but we wonder why they're being asked now and here. And so the very questions invite us to contemplate them, to move through this more tropological stage where we start to get a sense for their inner meaning, in order that as we listen in to Dante and Adam talking now, we too can move at least a little bit more towards the anagogic, the divine point of view. And first of all, Dante says to Adam, look, you know the questions that I want to ask. You share in the divine sight, you can see into my soul as well, therefore. It has a nice inflection here, because I think this is also about Dante recognising his kinship with Adam, the first human, in his own humanity. So, of course, there'll be a kind of porousness to their souls as they now stand blazing before one another. And Adam says that's true, that he knows Dante wants to ask four questions. He wants to ask, how long ago was he created? How long was he in the Garden of Eden? What was the truth behind the fall? What was the thing that really led to them being cast out of Eden? And fourthly, what was the language which he spoke in Eden? Now, Adam answers the third question first about the fall. In a way, it's the most important question. Certainly, it's the most important question for Dante now, as he's rising and returning to the divine. And Adam says something very, very interesting. He says it wasn't actually eating from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil that led to the fall. It was the way that they rushed towards wanting to eat of this fruit. They ate it too early. And I think that feeds back into this sense of Lucifer's fall, Judas's fall, Dante's risk, why in a way he has had to go on this whole journey down into the inferno, up through the purgatory, now rising steadily through the paradise, even with this most recent blindness as a crucial step along the way. It's precisely because if we rush too quickly towards the divine destiny, which is our telos, which is the end of the path that we're embarked on simply by being alive, but by being alive and by being held in this divine love, if we go at it too speedily, try to spiritually bypass, try to grab and possess, get ahead of ourselves with pride, all these facets that can be our undoing, then we become unaligned. We lose part of ourselves in that moment and so can't bring ourselves wholly to the divine, which is what we need in order to return to the divine. And remember, there's this other really profound insight in the incarnation, that the point about Jesus was that he was fully human as well as fully divine. And it was because of the full humanity that he was able to hold and channel and show in mortal life the fullness of divinity. And so that can't be rushed. It must be taken step by step, as Dante has been discovering. And Adam confesses to Dante now that the trouble for him and for Eve was that they ate of the fruit too soon. And in a way, their banishment was their inability to hold onto what they saw when they ate the fruit. It overwhelmed them. That was the inner meaning of their expulsion from the Garden of Eden. And it's a crucial thing for Dante to see now, because it's part of his humanity as well, that tendency to want to become divine too quickly. The process of theosis, of divination, can be our undoing as well as the making of us. Adam then answers the questions about the timings next. And I think the point about this is that they amplify this remark about things having to be in the right time, because he says to Dante that actually he and Eve were in the Garden of Eden for really quite a short period of time, just 6 hours. It was too short a period of time, you might say, for them really to become aligned to the divine life which was so present in the garden. And it meant that the period in which he was cast out of Eden, and then which he spent in limbo before the harrowing of hell, which has brought him back to heaven, that time was many thousands of years. I think it's not the actual quantity of years that counts here. The commentators do kind of tot it up. I think it's about 5,000 years in total. The point is that Adam spent a lot longer in this alienated state than he spent in the divine state, although that has been restored to him now. And that too tells us something about this journey, that it can take a long old time to make this return to God. And the sense of alienation can be profound, seemingly entrenched, seemingly unchanging. Remember, Adam spent a long time in limbo. It's speaking to us and to Dante here now about the nature of this divine journey. But the fourth question Adam answers in a way also is the assurance that the divine journey is back to the divine. And I think it's intimating it doesn't actually ever get lost. It doesn't ultimately and finally ever lose its way for we human beings, because Adam explains to Dante that the language they spoke in Eden was, in a way, you might say, the divine language. It was a language given to them by creation itself. It resonated with the divine word that had caused all things into being to start with. That was their first language, and in a way that's a language which never finally gets lost when humans speak. It resonates with the theme of love and goodness in this canto, because words can always help us find our way back to the divine when they're discerned, when they're spoken in the right way at the right time, with the right intention, the right desire and joy behind them. And in some ways, that is precisely what Dante himself has experienced in this canto, when in his moment of blindness, he turned to discourse, as John put it, in order to realign himself with the truest part of his soul, which of course is also the divine part of himself. So Adam, in answering this seemingly rather random question, what language did you speak in Eden, I think is reflecting on that for Dante as well. I mean, it's a very different sense of language from perhaps the most widespread now, which is that language is just mere empty signs, you know, as if our deep ancestors, the apes, first started grunting when they pointed at bananas, just a signal that was a banana that was over there or that they wanted, or just sort of rather empty signs. Now, this is a very different sense of language, which is that language is always already replete with meaning. There is actually a tradition of thinking about the evolution of language in this way, although it's the minority one now, because it makes the point that language is actually far more than just signs. It's a mode of communication always. That says, Adam ends the canto by stressing that in nature, as human beings are as well, all things change. And so, in fact, the language of humanity has changed too, much as the leaves on a tree will change and fall and new leaves grow into its place. So that explains why many languages are now spoken, and those languages can drift very dramatically from the experience of God that Adam knew originally. He describes it in a beautiful way. He says, originally he knew God as I. He knew God as a person, even as he was a person. Then God came to be known as El, as in the Elohim, which is another name for God given in the Hebrew Bible. And so the canto ends with a sense of restoration for Dante, not just that his sight is restored, not just that he is singing once again of love and hope and faith with the bright lights around him, and so sharing in the resonance and vitality of the heavens as himself once more. He's fine-tuned his capacity to do that. But in so doing, he's seen even more subtlety about his humanity by meeting the light of Adam. And as Adam has told him about this great arc of human evolution from the moment of creation in this mythological sense, so too he's understood something about his own humanity and how there is both within him the capacity to speak with divine words, but also because we are natural creatures as well, we can move a long, long way from that capacity too, as our desire and as our will and as what draws us in life takes us off the path, as much as it can bring us back onto the path of love. When I think for us now, unlike Adam, we recognise not only God as I, God as a person, but recognise our own I-ness, our own ability to say I am, that can reflect the divine I am. This is the difference that knowing of the incarnation makes. And so with the sense of restoration, with this sense of something completed now, the canto ends with us wondering quite where Dante is going to be able to find himself capable of journeying next. In one way, we know it's going to be into the Imperium, but in another way, how that can come about may seem still quite obscure and difficult. We've got to keep following Dante as his bark moves through these high heavenly waters and see whether we can keep seeing what he is increasingly able to discern.